And we're live.
Amala, please, let me tell you a joke.
Okay, I guess.
Okay, thanks. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
KGB.
KGB who?
We will ask the questions. KGB waits for no one.
I did not know how hard that slap was going to be.
That wasn't that hard.
No, it was good.
Intentionally
it was good.
Aimed for your
it didn't
headphone.
Hurt. It didn't hurt at all. Welcome, guys, to Will and Amala Live.
That was it. I thought you were going to do more of it.
What do you mean? What is? That's why I said that you need to play. You need to play Jim because what? Then Jim comes in and he goes, "Well, let me do a joke too."
Well, he's too far away.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just doesn't work. Anyways, guys, if you recognize that reference, it's from The Office. It's an encounter between Dwight and Michael Scott, and it relates to a KGB story that we are going to get to a little later. But first, we're going to start off with this story out of Los Angeles, our home, our pride, our not so much joy. Now, here's the headline. Classroom decorations at Alexander Hamilton High School in Los Angeles include F the police and F America with 3 K's, notice that, posters, flags representing Palestine and Black Lives Matter.
Are now, you say elementary school? Or what age school is
this? This is high school. This is a high school. So Alexander Hamilton High, which is interesting that it's called Alexander Hamilton High, here in Los Angeles, specifically Los Angeles Unified School District, which we've been having a lot of problems with when it comes to CRT, indoctrination, gender theory, horrible sex education. But here's the photo coming out of this classroom here. You can see the pride flag here. You can see the Black Lives Matter flag. You can see the trans flag. You can see the Palestinian flags. And then here's F the police and F America with KKK in the middle of it.
What does the poster actually say? I can't read it.
This is native land. Settler colonialism, genocide, slavery, imperialism, war on drugs, Jim Crow, prison something. I don't know what that
it's
last
like
word is.
It's like a bunch of random buzzwords.
It is.
Anti-American buzzwords on a poster and then a picture of Christopher Columbus. And then it's like America KKK.
This is like when you don't know the answer to a test. And so you write like everything that you thought you knew to try and get as many credit points as possible.
Right, right. In what way has America wronged people? Genocide, slavery, Jim Crow, mm-hmm. like anything you can think
if
of.
If this guy's your teacher and you write all those answers on the test, you're getting an A+.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, it's probably like a math class or something too. What I would be interested to know the race of the person who's a teacher. Does it say?
I'm not sure. No, I don't think they've not outed the teacher.
Why you gotta racialize everything,
this article.
Well, no, it'd be funny to know because if he is or she is a white person and they have this, you know, all about how bad colonizing is and all that. It's like, well, why don't you go back to Europe then? If you're like, go move away and give the land back to the natives. But of course you're not going to do that because you're a hypocrite.
I mean, that falls for everybody who complains about how hard it is to live in America and how bad it is to live in America. And then what are you doing here? And what place, as you write in your book, which I've been reading, what place is better in America? What place would you rather be in?
Here's a question. Do you guys think that there would be more public outcry, media coverage, angry parents, angry students, etc., if there were a teacher at the same high school that had the Ten Commandments listed on his wall, a bunch of scriptures, a bunch of Christian ideas
like a Trump
and thoughts.
Flag or something?
Sure. Do you think that would be more controversial?
Of course it would be. Of course it would be.
I think that's no school really has that anymore. I think it would be.
Yeah.
I think there would be a lot more heat taken for a teacher who does that than a teacher who does this.
I think that it's been lucky that we've seen the two teachers who we talked about a little while ago, the one who had kids salute to the pride flag or the trans flag, whatever, and then the guy who James O'Keefe exposed, Project mm-hmm. Veritas exposed, who also got fired. And so both of those teachers got fired, which is good. So I can't say for certain whether or not there would be more backlash with, you know, Christian stuff in a classroom at a public school and Trump stuff, whatever, or conservative stuff. So I think they would still get fired as well. I'll be honest, I think it would be the same.
The classroom is not the place to teach your preferred ideology or beliefs, no matter what it is. You can teach about different ideas, but you should not be. And having these posters on your wall is clearly like expressing your personal activism as a teacher. And that violates like the very essence of what a good ethical teaching is. It's not indoctrination. It's education. You're teaching kids how to think, not what to think. And by airing your particular biases out so much so that you have these giant posters blasting every wall of your classroom, you're not leaving you're not leaving anything to be guessed. Like, I had teachers who, over the course of a semester, you can kind of figure out what their leanings are.
Absolutely.
You know, and that I don't have a problem with that. But whenever they are posting their activist posters all over the room, and I'm sure if this is what's in their classroom looks like, just imagine what they're actually saying day in and day out, and how they're framing exactly what they're teaching, and what they're putting in their curriculum. Like, if there's a reason why we have standards like that of acceptable expectations for teachers and just in society in general. And there's a, like, you know, 5 years ago, probably, man, definitely 10 years ago, this would have been unthinkable to have someone who's so openly activist in a public high school, teaching your kids.
Yeah, I had a few teachers in high school where I was like, oh, I can definitely tell where you lie because it comes up here and there, or maybe they'll laugh, or you know, an election year comes around and you can sort of differentiate where one teacher falls and where the other one doesn't. But this one is just so blatant. I want to show one more picture out of this classroom, and this one is probably the most telling. Here's two posters here, and we'll read them. The first one says, coronavirus is not the crisis. Capitalism is the crisis. Settler nice. Colonialism is the crisis. Empire is the crisis. The disease arrived with the birth of America, again with KKK in the middle, and it's time we finally confront and heal it. Now, the second poster is a free Gaza poster, and it says, in 2020, make Israel Palestine again, and make America again with the KKK Turtle Island again. And what's really telling again about this picture is the little notes that they have on the side. One here says no peace up in the upper left corner. The upper right corner says I feel, which is so indicative of leftism. And the one in the bottom right says either we all win or no one wins.
Participation trophies. All, does that mean he gives out participation grades? Like,
right. Are you all getting A's? Or are you all getting F's?
Well, here's, actually, I kind of agree with the last statement, because I'll tell you.
Okay.
And not in
you
the
explain.
Sense that they mean it. Okay. But okay. In my speeches at my Blexit rallies, which is Candace Owens' nonprofit, and I go and speak at those. And one thing that I talk about is that conservatives aren't the racist people that the left likes to paint us as, mm-hmm. because we understand that if all minorities in America win and they flourish, then the whole country wins. And if minorities fail in this country, then the whole country will fail, because that's like a huge economic thing. And, you know, just morality, it's a bad thing. So I think that when everybody wins, you know, everybody wins. And when everybody loses, in a sense, individual competitions, I get it. We're not talking about,
yeah.
you know, obviously you want one winner who comes out on top.
Right. You can,
but just as like a whole, like, we should be looking for everybody to have a win. I mean, everybody should be at the best place possible for themselves.
Agreed. But you can definitely tell the sentiment expressed in this one has to do with equity and making sure that everybody's equal no matter what, and nobody yeah. stands out, and nobody's more successful than anybody
Will's
else.
Will's displaying his far left socialist tendencies.
Yeah, no, I'm a communist.
I agree with your statement.
Yeah, I actually teach this class. It's like undercover yeah, boss.
It's me.
I
that was when he had the mustache.
I am the
he got fired
president of the company.
No, but I mean, if you start from the assumption, then that's what's baked into this ideology, is the assumption that that economics is a zero-sum game, and that there's one set amount of money or wealth or whatever to distribute to everyone. There's one set amount of talent that we have to slice into perfectly even pieces. And that's not how it works. People are inherently different and have different abilities and different talents and specialties. Almost said specialities, like a British person.
Specialities.
But in a free society, you're going to have inequities. You're going to have, if you cannot force equal outcomes, and that's the whole premise on which socialism is built. And he has a poster against capitalism, which is actually the mechanism that creates enough wealth to elevate an entire country, to make it prosperous enough to where your lowest standard of living is much better than anything else we'd ever seen in history.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to note that the level of delusion with these people, because obviously you're entitled to your own political beliefs. Everyone is. That's the joy of living in America, which obviously this person doesn't appreciate it. But they don't think that these things are political. That's kind of like some of the delusion, is that they take it as like, this is a humanitarian struggle.
That's
this is
actually
like,
right, yeah.
This is like back in the day, like I remember being in elementary school, and like my teacher would be like, you know, there are kids starving in Africa, or like animals are becoming extinct because of deforestation and stuff like that. And those were just like issues that wasn't political. That was just like the way it was, you know? And mm-hmm. so everyone kind of knew about these things and was concerned about it. But now it's like these types of issues, these new political issues of Black Lives Matter and socialism and all these are like those new type of issues. If you get what I mean.
Yeah. I get
like
exactly
the
what
new
you mean.
Type of humanitarian crises that are plaguing our society, and people think they aren't political when in reality, these messages are pushed by political organizations that claim to be nonprofits, while really, I mean, they're giving money and talking to people in the DNC and all these other groups all over.
It's almost like God is dead in Western civilization and we have killed him, like my friend Will Witt in his book, How to Win Friends and Influence Enemies, available now on Amazon and everywhere books are sold.
That's true. Wow. We just reached number 36 out of all Amazon books.
That's awesome.
Number 36.
That is so
cool. But you diagnosed this exact thing. You talked about how leftism is the new religion. People have embraced it as a way to find meaning. And in the absence of the traditional framework that harkens back to Judeo-Christian values, mm-hmm. people have find meaning in this activism because we've abandoned traditional ways of getting meaning. And now the new meaning is destroying the old way.
Right.
It's like if people... This is why part of my book, like, and just changing minds in general and talking to people about this stuff, it's like, and I talked about this with Dennis too, it's like if you're batting 500 changing minds, that's pretty good because people have taken their leftism and that as a religion. And instead of thinking critically about things or saying, hey, this is my political ideology and I kind of separate it from my life, or, you know, this is what I think about economics, whatever. It's like, no, this is my moral framework.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The values of leftism are now who I am as a person. If you cut me in half, I mean, George Soros would spill out the middle like an alien creature. I mean, that's like what it is today with leftism, that it's no longer like a separate thing. Like you have the things you like and stuff like that. And then you have your politics. It's like, no, my politics is me. I come and you see me and you know what political affiliation I have, and it is my moral framework as a person.
Right, and that's something that we covered on the story yesterday about OkCupid. They are now allowing people to put their pro-life badges on their OkCupid profiles. And again, it's just indicative of the fact that we live in a culture now where your politics is who you are. It's exactly that. Which really this story points out is that you need to be watching what is in your child's classroom. As a parent,
Or take them out.
Yeah, or take them out if this is what's happening at school, because I don't think anybody wants their child falling victim to something like this, unless, of course, you are a leftist, and I'm sure you're overjoyed. But parents, teachers, educators, please keep a lookout on what kids are being taught.
I feel like if I was a conservative parent, mm-hmm. which one day I hope to be,
yes,
not a leftist parent, right. A parent in general.
I would hope not.
I would hope that I wouldn't want my teacher to be teaching them conservative values anyway. I mean, not like, no, I would want conservative values, but not like political values.
No.
You know, I wouldn't want them teaching about, you know, all that kind of stuff. Because first of all, I don't trust them. They're some college graduate and I don't trust them to teach them the values that I would want them to teach. And secondly, it's like, I want to teach them those values.
Yeah.
I feel responsible to do that, not the teacher. You teach them how to read and write and do math and the scientific theory. You teach them that, and I will teach them how to live their life.
Yeah, I agree. And politics has no place in the classroom, at least not when you're not in higher education. Parents have that right. Parents should be able to make that decision. They should have that privilege. And now teachers are stripping parents of that. And they're doing so in a secretive way, although not so secretive here. I don't know how long this went without getting on somebody's radar that this is happening, because, you know, at least when I was in school, your teacher would teach, administrators would come through, principals would come through, vice principals would come through at least a couple times every quarter just to check on the classroom and make sure everything was going all right. So somebody saw this and let it slide.
Yeah, my sister, she's a teacher, and she has like pictures of Drake mm-hmm. on her wall because she loves Drake and all the kids. She does like third grade and this kind of underprivileged school, and all the kids love Drake, and the administrators will message her sometimes and be like, I love the Drake poster. So it's definitely true. That's
right.
My anecdote, but it's true.
Somebody saw this and somebody let it slide. So,
exactly. Does that mean that they were aware of this and just they agree with that activism so much that they just let it slide or not? And I think there is an update to this story that I think the posters have been taken down since there's so much outrage about it generated
through
media. So, you know, sure, I'll take that victory, I guess. But like, the point is that this even, how did this even happen in the first place? And how was it allowed to continue?
Right. Which is why we have PragerU Kids. If you seem like you're struggling with your kid's education, or you're just scared about the indoctrination that's happening in schools' classrooms right now, or you just want good programs for your kids to be able to watch, you can go to PragerU.com/kids or PragerU.com/kidsbooks. And you can find all the different content that we have and books that we have and digital magazines that we have for children of all ages, just to get basic education, not indoctrination, just basic education. Now, here's a series that we do here at PragerU called Leo and Layla's Historical Adventures. And this one is on Pericles, which I don't think, do either of you know much about Pericles? I personally don't.
I know nothing about Pericles.
You're talking about the Greek.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Will knows that he's Greek.
No, I know a decent. If I'm thinking of the right person, Pericles is who killed Medusa.
Well,
Pericles killed Medusa with the mirror that looked back. I think I might be. Am I right, Scott? You know history.
We're about to find out.
We could all. Well,
be yeah, but I want to guess
by watching
first.
Leo and Layla.
I'm pretty sure I only got that from Clash of the Titans.
So. Okay. Scott said he's pretty Clash sure.
Of the Wait, the football movie?
Well, let's watch, and we're all going to learn something about Pericles.
Let's see if I'm right. I want to see if I'm right. I think
I'm excited to see Will be wrong, and then I'm excited to actually learn about Pericles.
There we go.
Through Leo and Layla.
I wish Mom and Dad would hurry up. What is taking them so long?
I just talked to Mom. She said the school board meeting is going long and that you have to be patient.
I don't want to miss the first pitch. How are you staying so calm?
We go to a couple baseball games every year, Leo. But it is weird that Mom and Dad are going to these meetings all the time now.
Dad keeps saying it's their civic duty. What does that even mean?
I know they're voting on stuff, but I don't really know. How about we keep you from exploding and go find out?
Ugh! Good idea. I need to take my mind off missing the first inning.
Okay. Let's see what we get with civic responsibility.
This can't be about Medusa. Now they're going back to find out.
Will's
going to
go ahead and get ahead of the L right now. Just go ahead and post your L.
Look it up, guys. If you're watching, look it up. I am like positive that Pericles.
Perseus. Positive.
Oh, okay, Perseus. Perseus killed Medusa.
Thank you, Scott. Scott went to Yale, so.
Yeah, seriously, Scott knows way more. All right, Perseus. Well, they all sound the same.
I'm going to sound stupid. I'm not going to say what I was going to say.
Is that, yeah.
Because in Percy Jackson, they go and they kill lightning? Medusa in
Wait,
the movie.
Really?
They do kill Medusa in Percy Jackson. They cut off her head and then they start
using
it. So
is he supposed to be like a modern Perseus interpretation?
That is a great question.
Yeah, he is. I mean, he's in the book, he's like a demigod.
He's a demigod,
I don't trust anything you say now.
No, I know about this. Trust me.
All right, well, let's actually learn about Pericles.
Whoa, what are we wearing? This place is cool.
I like my outfit. It kind of looks familiar, but it sort of doesn't. The phone says we're in 431 BC.
I've definitely seen that building before.
Excuse me, sir. Our time machine just dropped us off.
Where are we?
Who goes there?
Leo and Layla, sibling time travelers from the future. Who are you?
My name is Pericles, officially a strategos, like a governor / general. And I've been elected 15 times. But unofficially, I'm known as the first citizen of the greatest city in the ancient world, Athens.
Right.
There you go.
Let me just, I'll say something about Greek history that some people might not know.
Okay.
I'm actually not.
To redeem yourself?
Well, I'm just not the biggest fan of Athens. In terms of Greek history,
this
I think.
Is such a Will
I love it.
Just rabbit
saying,
hole.
Sorry, I'm just saying, because Athens didn't focus enough on creativity and stuff. They were too intellectual for their time. And so they put the creative stuff kind of aside. Like they went to more of an
Apollo. They created all their gods. That
well, they had more
creative.
Of an Apollo idea versus a Dionysian idea. Whatever, I'm just explaining this to you, all right? I'm telling you, this is what I think about it.
Anyways, okay. Well, I think Will needs to watch more Leo and Layla.
I think we all need to watch more Leo and Layla.
I'm going to go watch 300. And really find out about all this. That's your civic duty. What is your profession?
Ah, woo.
Oh my gosh. Anyways, guys, I have not. I'm right, sorry.
Fine.
Move I'm on. So sorry. Now we're going to get to the story that relates to our skit that we did earlier about the KGB. This is, you know, somebody who was very active in my red pilling experience, and that is Yuri Bezmenov. I found one of his videos where he talked about the idea of ideological subversion, although he says it with a Russian accent and it's much cooler. And here's that interview. We're going to talk about how this is happening here in America and how people don't tend to realize it. Let's get
Yuri
into it.
Yuri Bezmenov?
Yuri Bezmenov. This is from 1984.
He killed the Minotaur, right?
Oh, okay.
I'm just going to play
the video.
Okay.
Let's go. Bezmenov was born in 1939 in a suburb of Moscow. He was the son of a high-ranking Soviet Army officer. He was educated in the elite schools inside the Soviet Union and became an expert in Indian culture and Indian languages. He had an outstanding career with Novosti, which was the, and still is, I should say, the press arm or the press agency of the Soviet Union. It turns out that this is also a front for the KGB. He escaped to the West in 1970 after becoming totally disgusted with the Soviet system, and he did this at great risk to his life. He certainly is one of the world's outstanding experts on the subject of Soviet propaganda and disinformation and active measures. Well, you spoke several times before about ideological subversion. That is a phrase that I'm afraid some Americans don't fully understand. When the Soviets use the phrase ideological subversion, what do they mean by it?
Ideological subversion is the slow process which we call either ideological subversion or active measures, активные мероприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow, and it's divided in four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism.
Does that sound familiar at all? Does it sound like the story that we just covered? It's very, very clear that this is happening in America. And again, this video is from 1984. So he was warning us about this back then. Look at how far we've gone since then.
The decline of the West from within.
Yeah, and it's just something so telling is to just hear people who have been through this sort of communist takeover, the Soviet Union, come over here and say, hey guys, like, please listen to me. This is happening right now. Here are the stages of which it's happening in, and here's how we can stop it. Here's what you should do to respond to it. And still, it just goes in one ear and out the other.
Yeah, the fact that he was referring to this as something that had already happened, like there, he says, yes, like they're a generation deep in 1984,
yes,
which is kind of true if you think about like Frankfurt School and the introduction of postmodernism and all and neo-Marxism into American universities in the 1960s. That's when these ideas began to take root and take hold in America. But now, so if that's how deep it was in 1984, and he was already sounding the alarm then, seeing what's happening. Fast forward, how many, 40 years now? I still think of the 80s as 20 years ago. I just always will. Mm-hmm. But it's like 40 years later.
Right.
And just look at, we have in our public schools, anti-American, Marxist, anti-capitalist messages in a public high schools in the U.S. And not to mention the fact that it's in our movies. It's everywhere in American society and on every imaginable institution.
Right.
It's in our woke companies and all this stuff. So, yeah, I mean, he was right, unfortunately. Yeah. Here we are.
It's a little weird that this was filmed in 1984. That's actually interesting.
To talk about the first step being demoralization, we talked about, I've been talking about this with Scott lately, like it's demoralizing. It's like we just had this failed election in California. Mm-hmm. Like people are brainwashed, ideologically possessed, and keep pursuing and voting for the things that they that are taking away their rights, leading them more down the path toward Marxism. And it's like you can, he talks about it. I don't know if we already passed this point in the video, but he talks about how you can like point, look at, bring someone to the concentration camp.
He'll and get
point,
there.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe I should let it play. But
yeah. But the important point that he makes it just very quickly here is despite the abundance of information.
Exactly.
Despite the abundance of information, and he's going to elaborate on that, but it's so true. Despite all the information that we have right in front of our faces, we still fall into these ideological holes.
The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already. For the last 25 years, actually it's overfulfilled because demoralization now reaches such areas where previously not even Comrade Andropov and all his experts would even dream of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who was demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Even if I shower him with information, with authentic proof, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him by force to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camp, he will refuse to believe it. Until he is going to receive a kick in his fat bottom. When a military boot crashes his balls, then he will understand, but not before that. That's the tragic of the situation.
And that's just a very crass way of saying what we've said on the show for a very, very long time, is that you don't understand the failings of your ideology, the failings of what you legislate and what you change in your society until it harms you. And until it harms you almost in a way that is inescapable and irreversible. And that's exactly the point that he makes here.
No, the way he described it is pretty irreversible.
Yeah, that's...
That would hurt.
That's pretty harmful.
That would wake me up for sure.
Yeah.
We've talked about that before, like the quote, the only way character changes is pain. And like when you're raising a kid, there have to be consequences to their actions, mm-hmm. because that's how they learn. And I wonder, and we've talked about this in recent weeks as well, where is the rock bottom? And as long as people, like especially elites, can be insulated in their from the policies that they keep voting for that harm the lower class people, that as long as they're still insulated from that, they're not going to feel the pain of their own terrible ideas. And we also you can look at like economically, we keep kicking the can down the road with the debt, and it's like we're not feeling the pain, we're kicking it off to future generations. And there will be a reckoning. You cannot just make withdrawals forever. That you're going to have to pay the debt that you owe. And we owe a debt to the truth. We owe a debt to facts. We owe a debt to good values and morals. And mm-hmm. you can't keep going further and further down the rabbit hole without it coming to bite you. And it will.
Yeah, it's like you either make a deal with the devil or you make a deal with God. You kind of have to choose. Say like what type of life am I going to live? And it's interesting. When I was in college and everything, and eventually I was on the left and then an atheist. And then you start hearing what the truth is, all mm-hmm. the conservative thoughts, and listening to the best thinkers and reading. And you're like, wow, the world is so much different than I thought. I don't understand how when you have that truth, you can't speak it out into the world. I feel like that if you know these things, at least this is how I felt, mm-hmm. that it's like once I knew the truth after being lied to for so long, I wanted to go on top of a building on my campus and just scream all of my ideas and all my conservative ideas at everyone who was walking by. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt. I mean, that's why I do what I do now, because I want to scream those ideas out because I know the truth after being lied to for so long. I feel like that's what it takes. It takes people realizing they've been lied to get that kind of fire in them to say, hey, I want to come and speak out now.
Yeah, it has to be personal. And that's what he sort of says here with you have to get kicked pretty hard by the actual military boot itself to feel it. I mean, we did a story a while ago back when the crisis in Cuba was really at its peak and the media was talking about it, about these girls who were waking up who were supporters of Black Lives Matter. And then when Black Lives Matter came and blamed the United States for what happened in Cuba, they couldn't believe it. And that's the kick. You get the kick and all of a sudden you're like, oh, well, there's something wrong with where my brain is going. I have some sort of cognitive dissonance when it comes to my political beliefs, and it wakes you up. And he talks about how even seeing the concentration camps themselves is not effective in waking somebody up because it's not personally affecting them.
Yeah, well, just, I mean, look at Australia right now and the authoritarian madness that we're seeing of like military patrolling the streets. There's that graphic image of the 70-year-old woman who got pushed down and pepper sprayed in the face for attending a protest. And it, like, this is blatant authoritarianism happening
right
now in front of our faces. And yet, is that enough of a kick for people to wake up? I have a friend who's an Australian, and I follow her on Instagram still, and she's been posting these some stories, and basically in support of the lockdowns and criticizing the people who are protesting against them. And it's like, how does not being allowed to leave your home and witness, how are you able to witness all of this stuff and still support it? And like, we just saw Canada reelected Trudeau, and like, at what point, where is the kick? How hard does the kick have to be to actually wake people up?
That's
like, what if Australia
question.
Reelects their current government and allows them to continue going down this path? Like,
I don't know.
Where does it stop?
I don't know. It has to.
We watched that psychosis video, you know, and it's along the same lines of what he's talking about. It just feels like people are, like, scared people do stupid things and vote for stupid things and stop thinking for themselves and then start to go into this, you know, for the greater good, for the common good collective mentality. And that is how you slide right into authoritarianism.
Yeah, it goes to
show. The same people who told you that you have to support them because they're the ones who will take you out of trouble and make you the world a better place again are the same ones who put you in there in the first place.
Yep. like we always say,
Stockholm syndrome.
Everybody who you vote for, or who sits in power, is capable of fixing all the problems that they scream about, and they just choose not to because they thrive on problems. We have no politicians if we don't have problems. We have no bureaucrats if we don't have problems. So it is in their best interest to keep those problems alive. Let's keep going.
Of demoralization. The next stage is destabilization. This time, subverter does not care about your ideas and the patterns of your consumption. Whether you eat junk food and get fat and flabby, it doesn't matter anymore. This time, and it takes only from 2 to 5 years to destabilize a nation, what matters is essentials. Economy, foreign relations, defense systems. And you can see it quite clearly that in some areas, in such sensitive areas as defense, an economy, the influence of Marxist-Leninist ideas in the United States is absolutely fantastic. I could never believe it 14 years ago when I landed in this part of the world that the process will go that fast. The next stage, of course, is crisis.
Let's stop on destabilization before he gets to the next one. But it is really interesting. Again, this was filmed in 1984, and he's citing that the process started 25 years prior. So 1959, and now we are nearly 40 years ahead from there. That is terrifying, terrifying. And he talks about defense contractors and our economy, our central banking system, and he talks about how they are some of the most influential when it comes to this Marxist-Leninist ideology. Have we not covered stories of Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and JP Morgan and American Express and all of these massive companies that are in line with centralized banking and defense contracting that are covering CRT, which is essentially racialized Marxism?
Yeah,
it's wild.
Or even like the military ads that we watched and stuff, like recruiting ads are focusing on identity politics and what gender and sexuality that the new recruits of the FBI and CIA and the Army are. That's the emphasis of how we're building our military around that and being able to make pregnant, jumpsuits and all that type of stuff. And like, meanwhile, we talk about it like China's, and like we watch the Russian ad of their military and how it's like these badass guys who are like just dominating and fighting and stuff. And it's like, where do you think this is going? And this is exactly the destabilization he's talking about.
And it only gets worse from here. He's talking about it from the perspective of, this is happening covertly. And I'm just trying to let you know that this is happening and it's going to come to fruition and it's going to get louder and louder. Now we're in the stage here in America where it's happening overtly. So very, very scary. Let's hear about stage three.
It may take only up to 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. You can see it in Central America now. And after crisis, with a violent change of power, structure, and economy, you have so-called the period of normalization. It may last indefinitely. Normalization is a cynical expression borrowed from Soviet propaganda. When the Soviet tanks moved into Czechoslovakia in 68, Comrade Brezhnev said, now the situation in brotherly Czechoslovakia is normalized. This is what will happen in the United States if you allow all these schmucks to bring the country to crisis, to promise people all kind of goodies and the paradise on earth, to destabilize your economy, to eliminate the principle of free market competition, and to put a big brother government in Washington, D.C., with the benevolent dictators like Walter Mondale, who will promise lots of things, never mind whether the promises are fulfillable or not.
And he talks about how rapidly a country can enter into crisis. Can you remember maybe a pandemic crisis that we rapidly entered into very quickly in this country? I don't know, maybe 2 years ago.
Never heard of her.
Doesn't ring a bell.
And then he says a violent shift in power in our leadership in a country. Did we not also experience that? Although I would call it more of a Cold War violence than actual violence. Definitely experienced that as well. So at what stage are we in this process? The very last stages of this process.
It seems like it's already over. Seems like we're just living in a new reality.
Normalization.
Yeah.
Exactly. Things are becoming normalized in an overwhelming sense. All of these social issues that we talk about are becoming normalized. So
if you're still a free thinking person who would rather bet on yourself than the government to determine the course of your life and take care of you, you're now in the minority. You are the rebel. You're the radical minority.
You're the counter.
And you are the strange person.
I think the normalization comes with how used to tyranny we get and how much we can take, and like the masks and the lockdowns and the letting people loot your businesses and steal from you and homeless people on the street. All these things have become incredibly normal, and we just get used to them. And we say, well, this is what we do now. And that's where the demoralization and the normalization, I mean, they all come together, and it's just like, well, give them an inch and they're going to take a mile every single time.
It's true. Everything is becoming normalized, and rapidly so. We are so easily conditioned now that even things that would have been considered extreme even 5 years ago are no longer considered extreme. We do it on the show. We hear stories that to anybody else's who has not, you know, seen the cultural shift in America, these stories would be crazy. And now we look at things and we go, well, that's not shocking anymore. We can go on the internet, on Twitter, and see videos of gang violence, of like a woman just being shot in the street holding her child. And we're just like, well, that's normal. We see this all the time. And it's just wild how rapidly things can become normalized once you've been exposed to them and desensitized. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad.
Well, it is sad because that's the world that we live in, that we have to be fine with all this type of tyranny. That sucks. That sucks that we have to just deal with it, you know, and there's more that we can do to fight back. I mean, I think there is a lot that we can do. We're seeing parents go to school board meetings, and we're seeing people refuse to do mask mandates, and we're seeing restaurants refuse to enforce tyranny. So there is a lot that we can do. But it's sad that we have to do those things to fight against what is this new normal that they are putting on us.
Now we're going to move on to another story here, and we're going to cover this very, very quickly. Uma Thurman entered the political space this past week to talk about abortion, specifically the Texas heartbeat bill. Here's the opinion piece. Uma Thurman: the Texas abortion law is a human rights crisis for American women. Now, I urge you to go and read this in its totality to get her view of this. She tells a personal story about her own personal experience with receiving an abortion in her, I want to say, late teens, I believe. So while in Europe, was impregnated by an older man, at first wanted to keep her child, and then called her parents, had a discussion with her parents, and after further questioning and really talking about whether or not it was smart for her to follow through with this pregnancy, she decided to terminate with assistance from her family and assistance from friends over in Europe. And she talks about how now that she's a mother of three, that abortion was, although difficult, a good thing for her to do because it allowed her to grow into the mother and the person that she needed to be to have children.
Kill Bill turned into Kill Baby. How horrible is that? What?
Nothing. Nothing.
That's horrible. It's the murder of a child.
It is horrible. Now, she writes in here, I want to read this last part. I am grief-stricken as well that the law pits citizen against citizen, creating new vigilance who will prey on these disadvantaged women, denying them the choice to not have children they are not equipped to care for, or extinguishing their hope for the future family they might choose.
It's a tough argument of hers to battle against and say, you know, because this is her own circumstance where she's like, okay, I got an abortion and then I was able to grow as a person and then have a family. It's like hard for you to say like, oh, well, you know, getting into her shoes and trying to rationalize and explain it. But there are tons of examples of wonderful women who got pregnant when they were younger, still had the baby, and then lived amazing, beautiful lives, or had children who had amazing, beautiful lives. Justin Bieber's one, for example, where his mom was thinking about getting an abortion but didn't, kept him alive. And then look at their life. I mean, some of the most successful people on the planet for and still, you know, having that child when they were younger and unplanned. So that's not an excuse. You know, it's saying that you want to grow and you want to be successful, so you murder a child is not an excuse for murder.
Right. You can't gloss over the whole premise of our argument glosses over the fact that in order to achieve the outcome that you are dressing up and as so great now is that you had to terminate a human being. You had to kill a baby. Mm-hmm. And you, like, the question is not all this peripheral stuff around it and how all the reframing is just a distraction from the central question, which is, did you kill a human life? And that you know, and it's not denying you the choice. It's that kid never had a choice to live, and you took that from them, and you can't do that.
When I was a teenager, you know, I killed this guy because it helped me really get my success up later in life. And now I love people, but as a teenager, I killed this guy because it made me more successful.
Right. Even like, imagine if it were a bully. And you know, it's like, I killed a bully because he was making my life a living hell. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, that you're not justified in that because murder is not an option.
Right.
And I don't know, just because, you know, it's a... We find a way around it to justify murder, and that you can't gloss over that. That is the central question, and every single time this comes up, and you don't gloss over it.
Right. Yeah, and again, you have a choice. As a teenager, she had the choice to not have sex with a man and then subsequently get pregnant. She had the choice to not do that. She followed through and did that. And now we're supposed to say, well, now you get the choice to run away from what you've done. Now you get a choice to run away from your actions. When has that ever been reasonable? Do we teach kids that, oh, well, if you make a mistake, you don't have to face the consequences of that mistake anymore? You
can just... I mean, that's what they teach them now.
Well, I'm saying...
You shouldn't teach them, but that is what they teach them.
In your heart, you know that you don't teach kids that. You know that kids, when they make a decision and it's a harmful decision, that they have to reap what they sow and they have to have accountability for what they've done and responsibility for what they've done. At any point in human history, have we ever run away from that until now? No, we have not. So it's amazing that now we get to sort of play God, in a sense, and just erase... decisions that we've made and the consequences of those decisions when, yes, you do have a choice. And I want to highlight something that she says here, again, in her own personal writing. There is so much pain in this story. It has been my darkest secret until now. Mm-hmm. There's a reason there's so much pain in the story. There's a reason that it has been your darkest secret until now. And it's because you know that it's wrong. And I'm glad that she's come into the space and admitted what she's done. But you have a feeling, an innate feeling, and you know that it's wrong. And nobody ever talks about the depression that women feel after abortions. Instead, they like to paint it as, oh, well, I just went to the abortion clinic and now I feel great and now my future is secured and everything's going to be fine. No, you experience psychological damage after getting an abortion. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that this is damage that she has held with herself for nearly 30 plus years.
Yeah, if everything's so great now because of the decision that you made, why is it your darkest secret?
Right. And
why is there so much pain around this part of the story? You're admitting your guilt, but then in the same article that you're saying I felt guilty about and this was my dark decision, you're dressing it up as this great thing. And it's like, which is it? Is it a dark decision? Is it a painful story in your life that you feel guilt over? Or is it this awesome thing that was just the best decision ever and morally good?
Yeah. And we know that it's the awful thing that was a horrible decision. And she even states that she wanted to keep the kid at first. It wasn't until talking to her parents that she got convinced out of doing so. And you know that it's wrong. And to then go and advocate for other young girls to have this choice is wrong. Yeah, so that's my thoughts on Uma Thurman. We're going to move to our last segment of the day. Hopefully,
I love the Kill Bill movies, and I love Pulp Fiction. I think that she's a great actress, so this is disappointing for me to see. Quentin Tarantino is like my favorite director.
Yeah.
So it's disappointing to see this. I can't watch those movies the same.
It is disappointing. You know? It is very, very disappointing. But, you know, it is what it is. At least we can talk about it. And you know what? At least the story, at least she's honest about how bad of an experience it was for her, because hopefully young girls will read that and know. And you'll get a feeling that it's wrong.
But, you know, which message are they going to walk away with? Are they going to walk away with,
yeah,
Uma Thurman said she got an abortion and it was great and mm-hmm. it really helped her life? Mm-hmm. Or are they going to read it and say, oh, if she had a dark decision and it was painful and so I shouldn't get it? You know, I don't think, I think
it's
much
the
more
latter.
The former.
Yeah, but it's probably the former. Yeah. Sad. Well, anyways, we're going to get into our last segment of the day.
Tough transition.
Yeah, hopefully.
Usually so
I was like, we need a lighthearted segment to end after if we're going to discuss
this abortion
thing.
Yeah, we do need a lighthearted segment to end with, and this is why we chose memes to react to for you guys. Here's Taylor's.
So we each picked one. This is one of my favorite accounts on Instagram. It's middle class fancy.
I need to follow
them. It's basically like dad jokes and like stereotypical white people making fun of white people. That's great.
When Karen from accounting asks what time your dentist appointment is and you say 2:30 because you feel like being a silly goose today. Taylor!
2:30! Oh, dad jokes are the best.
They are the best.
Look, it's not the heat that gets you. It's the humidity.
No, I love telling dad jokes. Sometimes he laughs.
Gosh, the real hot part of the pepper is the seeds. That's what you gotta watch out for.
Exactly.
Here's Will's. Ooh, I don't care about mandates because I don't date men.
That's right, brother. I don't date men, man.
No, it's not bad. That one's pretty good.
Fantastic. Made me chuckle. I just looked at it and I smirked.
I too did the very, very same. I'm trying to pull up mine as we speak because I downloaded it and it won't let me open two at the same time. Jeez. Here's mine. Calling yourself non-binary categorizes everybody into binary or non-binary, creating a binary system which makes you binary again. Until next time.
Checkmate, libs.
Yeah.
Checkmate, libs.
Got him. Thanks, great. He-Man.
Anyways, guys, thank you so much for watching. Please like, subscribe, click the notification bell to be notified every single day when we go live, 2:30. PST, 2:30. 5:30 Eastern.
2:30?
2:30.
Oh, I'm going to say that every day now.
Oh, gosh.
Tune in at 2:30.
2:30. You can watch us or listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Play. Go and leave us a 5-star review. Also, guys, it is still Will's book launch week. Go and buy his book, How to Win Friends and Influence Enemies, Taking on Liberal Arguments with Logic and Humor, on Amazon or anywhere that you can buy books. Leave him a 5-star review as well, because the leftists are coming after him pretty hard.
Yeah, it's awesome. I love it when they come after me. So
Will thrives with the fire.
No, I'm in the gates of Thermopylae fighting against the Persians. See, there's my Greek reference.
There
right.
you
okay,
go.
There we go. Right?
There's the accurate
fine,
one.
Fine. And it was Theseus who killed the Minotaur.
Good job, Will.
The only Greek you know about is the Greek salad at Panera Bread.
Which is really good, by the way.
I do love a good feta.
Thank you guys so much for watching. We will see you Friday. Yeah.
Peace. I won't.
Will won't. But Taylor and I will be here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, guys, bye.
Bye.
I already took my headphones off. This is over.